Hello, my name is Kylie De La Cruz, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Dr. Phoebe R. Stubblefield, who is visiting Dickinson to give a lecture, Finding Unity in History, Our Community Process for Covering Victims of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. Dr. Stubblefield is the director of the C.A. Pound Human Identification Laboratory at the University of Florida and the lead forensic anthropologist in the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre investigation. Her work with the Tulsa community and its history first began when she signed on as a scientific consultant for the Tulsa Race Riot Commission in 1997. In recognition of her work in the massacre investigation, Dr. Stubblefield was inducted as a fellow into the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2023. Welcome, Dr. Stubblefield. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's see. I'll start with something a little general. What would you say is the most exciting part of your job?
My job all the time, like as a forensic anthropologist, or my job with Tulsa? There's so many hats.
Either one.
Oh, okay. Most exciting. So for Tulsa, It depends if it's just my role or our role, but if it's just my role, I find exciting when we see something on x-ray, and we never have any expectations, but when we see something on x-ray that we want to bring our colleagues in, it doesn't even matter if it's something trauma related, we get so few artifacts, personal effects, that those two, if it makes a good x-ray, if just our colleagues get excited, I'm excited, it's great. With my forensic work on the regular at the Pound Lab, truly the most exciting moment, most won't agree with me here, is during the first inspection of remains, if they need, even if they don't need cleaning, I'm just going to nutshell it and say cleaning, but inspecting a skeleton that first round, just getting to know what the bones are like, how good the preservation is or not, or if there are any features that are readily observable that say, hey, if I had an x-ray, you would see this, and maybe I'll get an identification. Not that that will actually happen, but I like to see that. It's really a peaceful time, and it generates that, again, the moment of connection, because I can go to my students and say, hey, but I actually technically have to wait until they discover it. I can't just point it all out. It takes away from the learning. So, yeah.
What do you think is the most surprising thing about skeletal analysis for students to find out when they're first getting used to this process or starting to do it themselves?
I think, one of the difficult aspects is that bones they don't come clean, you know, just automatically cleaned, and how much, I think they get surprised how much soft tissue can linger, and the effects of that, even when it's dry soft tissue. Sometimes I shock people by saying, those bones are clean, and there's mummified tissue on them, and no, that's fine, that's clean, you know. I mean, it's not like we're going to put it in our mouth, so it's clean. And their definition of clean is like a commercially prepared skeleton, right? Because it depends on each individual temperament or interest or drive or motivation, but lately, not in my lab, but in my discipline, we've been addressing what to do with commercially prepared skeletons, and we have a donor program, and so people will donate their bodies to science specifically for their skeletons to come to the lab and keep teaching. And the amount of work to get from the whole body donation to a skeleton, I think my students appreciate it now. But their expectations, actually, I think they appreciate forensic cases better now, because decomposition is our friend. But again, that whole aspect of, there's so much work involved. Rarely do I see anyone, I don't struggle with the horror stories. There are horror stories. I don't struggle with those, but I sometimes think my students do, but it's individual.
So earlier this week, we screened the documentary, The Fire and the Forgotten, and in the documentary, I don't remember who it was, but someone described this work as retelling the last chapter of someone's life. Mm-hmm. And it also mentioned that it can get pretty easy to become attached to these lives that you guys are like not recreating, but learning more about. If you're comfortable sharing, what has been your experience, like emotionally and mentally working with these people? Mm.
Overall, because I've delved into more history than I would have normally for my forensic work, and I've spent a lot of hours searching for and reading death certificates and newspaper articles, and all of that history, collective history, has shown me that I'm grateful for living now. The age of antibiotics is a true blessing. We will never know. I mean, we just cannot appreciate, even reading the death certificates, how much better we have it now, just because of that alone. But some of the stories aren't the stories of the victims of the race massacre, because death certificates come in batches, and it's everyone that got certificated. And so I'll see stories where so often it's a young mother that died right after childbirth, and the story has followed enough into the newspaper accounts that I can almost trace just a decline. And, you know, the husband, this one story, I can't remember his name, fortunately, I had found the wife's death certificate because she died after like a bad tear during delivery. And it was her second, I think, child. Might have been her second child. But she was working on her second husband by then. And her first, it's her story with her passing, but the second husband, she was his second wife too, because his first wife had divorced him. I don't know why, or they had gotten a divorce, and she got the kid. She went on, the first wife, to live and do all the things, you know, everything typical. But he remarries, his second wife dies, and about a year later, I find his death certificate. He died in a hotel room that had gas heat. So they used to have these, I don't know what it actually looks like, but it's, think like a gas lamp, but operating in your hotel room, not out on the street, so it's producing carbon monoxide, mm-hmm. but you know, you leave the window open and all is hopefully well. Well, he didn't leave the window open, and I doubt that was an accident. I'm just thinking it wasn't, but yeah, stories like that where you get more pictures of how people were living or not living well. Sometimes I see those, I share those stories with my colleagues, but they don't yeah, I'm just never sure what you know, how much of a window we're getting into the lives at the time, because certainly the biggest one is just, it was just hard. Harder to live to get old, not that people didn't, but it was just so much easier to die of some random infection, and now we take them for granted that we'll put some triple antibiotic ointment on it and go about our day, or just wash the cut. Who knew? So, yeah, it's as far as the victims that we're looking for, many of them don't show up as well on paper as I would like. I suspect my historian colleagues would disagree with me there, because I was taking the track of trying to find them in censuses and newspaper articles. Only a few of them have shown up there. And like the ones that were veterans would almost certainly have a military file. I haven't tried to get it. My genealogical colleagues do that, and I'm happy to let them keep doing that. But sometimes I can't find them in the census either. Like there's a Captain Wheeler, I think his rank was captain. He was targeted and killed based on a newspaper article after the riot. He still has descendants in Tulsa, or the Tulsa area. And so they knew of their ancestor. And I have his death certificate. He had a certificated death, but his family, that story doesn't show up as well through censuses. And so How well do I get to know them? As well as me going, I still can't find anything. Next. And so some of the stories. The Ella Morrison story, I put more weight on her story just because she does show up a little better, fortunately, in historical records, because women at the time don't show up well unless they were the last the survivor and their estate went to probate. Women can be very hard to find. It's left me going, get in the census, get a driver's license, do something that makes you show up, because women get married and that last name changes, and then you can't find them. I mean, unless you get a marriage certificate or luck out and they married a neighbor, and you can see them side by, you know, in neighboring houses in the census, you're not going to find them. Even when it's a small town. I mean, it takes a very determined person, and then you always, you're left with the, is it the same person? The same, is that that woman? And, yeah. And often it is, actually. You find out later, but on the, if they lived until the age of Social Security, then you find out, yep, it's the same person. But the certainty isn't there until you get there. So Ella Morrison, we wanted to find her. We didn't know who she was. We knew she was Mrs. Morrison. But she has, I'll talk about this briefly, hopefully, in my talk tonight. There's so many slides and so little time. It's just so, because the story just gets longer, you know, as it, every season, there's just something added, and I have trouble subtracting anything. But the right away when we first started, when it was my colleagues, Scott Ellsworth, still alive, our historian, but he had a partner, Dick Warner, and Dick Warner has since long since passed, and they had collected interviews from survivors and perhaps actors or perpetrators, but two, but either way, they had interviews of people still living, and in their review of interviews and documents, they'd read the Red Cross director's final report in December 1921, and he had mentioned that he had the he had Arthur Morrison in his hospital, and Arthur was an orphan because his mom died due to her injuries in the riot. And so we don't have any women. You know, there are no female victims. And so the genealogist that we came forward in 2018 and got reorganized and had our first field season and not, didn't get anything. And then our second field season, we started exhuming people. And we hired the genetics company with their genealogists. And I was talking to the genealogist, and I said, hey, you know, we've got this Arthur Morrison, and we don't know where Mrs. Morrison is, and I've been looking through the death certificates and haven't had any Morrisons in Tulsa County. Well, they went the census route and just records. They went historical records route, and they found on the census Arthur with his siblings, his parents, Ella, and her husband's name, not Charles, that's his son, Joseph, I think. And the problem had been that they went by the last name of Morris or Morrison.
Interesting.
And I was only looking for Morrisons. And so I hadn't thought about the name variation, and the genealogists are always on that, especially because back then, if you couldn't read, how do you spell your name, for one thing? And was it Joe? Anyway, they're the Ella's husband. He was a freedman, and his father's name was Morris, but the father went by Morris Colonel. Colonel was the name of the slave owner.
Mm-hmm.
So Morris Colonel was Joe's father, but he didn't want to be a colonel. He wanted to be a Morrison,
yeah,
or a Morris. So he went by that name. And then he passes away, but not before they show up in the, I think it's the 1910 Tulsa census.
Wow.
And, well, Oklahoma census, but they're there with all the kids. And then after, how far did I look? The genealogist got a hold of Ella's death certificate, or else I ordered it. I've ordered most of them. And then the informant on her death certificate was her sister, Biona, and Biona's just not a common name, and she's in Tulsa, Biona's in Tulsa at the same time that Ella is. And then later, Biona moves to California and has her nephews from Ella with her. At least one of them moves with her to California, to Los Angeles. And so all those connections come together, and it makes quite a history. I don't even know if there are descendants of the Morrisons there now. Really, it would be the Houstons, Ella's side of the family, at this rate. I don't know if any of them exist in California and know that we've traced them that far. And that they're connected to the race massacre, because their mother had a miscarriage and died of septicemia because of the race massacre.
That's incredible that you were able to go back that far, or...
And rarely do women show up as well. Even though Oklahoma wasn't as terrible about documenting women's lives, but, like, I mean, probate records existed, but sometimes, you know, women couldn't own property. I mean, your lifetime, you could have a credit card, but in my lifetime, it wasn't until the 70s that a woman could get a credit card on her own. And so I just barely skimped into that time span, but still.
You express concern in your opinion piece, Taking Human Remains on a Cultural Shift, when it comes to publishing your work on the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre investigation due to the representation and exploitation of Black bodies in academia. Thinking about legislation like NAGPRA, but also our own individual choices as scholars and also as forensic anthropologists, how can we ensure that the agency of Black people and their bodies are protected from scientific exploitation?
Well, it depends on the we. So we're in a position now with our modern bodies, if we're still in control of our flesh, that we could make plans for our remains. You know, we could do that. It's heinously expensive as the funeral or mortuary industry can be. We could make plans. That alone just removes a lot of the hurdles of the past, because we are in literally a cultural shift. And I try not to judge, even though my field was founded on grave robbing, battlefield looting. You know, people couldn't even get into a mass grave before they were dismantled and taken off for research. So, but that was able to happen because we didn't then have much respect for people's bodies in the way that they're connected to their kin who might want to mourn, and we didn't respect that. And we respect it a little bit more now, but I think that's because we do have more control, all of the we, you know, Black, white, you know, you name it, because we have a chance, maybe, to make plans. We have power to control our tissue when it's like, don't anatomical gifts. You know, you donate a kidney, you can choose to donate. You donate your corneas. Okay, that's a end of life choice. You've made the choice. So that ability and habit of making choices, we're better at it. We're not perfect. Indigent donation, where the county donates your remains, still legal. And it's legal because it is a reasonable choice, I find, for managing the uncontrolled dead. So these are the dead where the next of kin either won't or don't know, because they have not been informed about their next of kin. And but if they won't manage the remains, then there's a chance that the person will go to research. And, you know, going to research is maybe a colder approach, but I often realize I don't actually know what's going on with people's next of kin. And sometimes relationships just get worn out, or there aren't any kin. So I think the best approach is to make plans, especially if someone's very marginalized, foster system, or they're the last of their family. Make your own plans if you want to avoid having your remains end up in any system. But on the other hand, who cares, literally, if you are marginalized? So it goes right back to make your own plans, because only your kin want to control your dead. And if you don't have any, or if you've worn them out, indigent donation is still an option in many states. And so, but as far as people like the victims I'm looking for, those people in the cemetery who were properly buried, there's just no reason for anyone like that to enter into a lab system where they turn into specimens that go on, because they were buried once. They were there, they were going to dust. They can go back to going to dust on their time. And there's no reason to funnel them into that kind of setting, people who were funeralized and mourned. Now, I say that knowing full well that there are times when you have to move a cemetery and there's no plan, or you'll never move a cemetery without a plan, by the way, for where to put the remains. But the plan may be education only. I get that. I don't, especially in this age of DNA analysis where you might be able to reconnect the person with their family if they weren't embalmed. I don't think the plan should be to funnel people into education without consent of the family, just because I think of educational donation as a delayed funerary process, because sitting on a shelf, having the shelf pulled open to access the remains, shutting it again, you're gradually still grinding the remains to dust. It's just in a different setting than under the ground. A delayed process. So I like to question, why did I interrupt a process to put it in even more delay when the person didn't, that wasn't their plan to begin with? So, or especially, do I really want to interrupt the next of kin with this, you're a great grandfather, because that's what we're doing with Tulsa. And we have just perfected, I hope perfected, our process for that, because we weren't getting IDs at first, so we didn't know how to react to our own, hey, we found your great uncle and he died here. You didn't even know you had the great uncle. And surprise! So how does that happen when, I was doing a DNA analysis on these teeth that we recovered from the cemetery, and meanwhile, you were sitting there thinking, yeah, I got next of kin in such and such county. And nope, because we dug them up and put them in the university because the cemetery went derelict and we didn't tell anybody. We didn't contact the community. So aside from making plans, the best approach is for people like me, well, but I'm forensic, so usually I don't have a concern about a collection. You know, Tulsa is the closest I come to that. But if we can just keep the community involved, have them notified, you know, the agencies moving cemeteries are supposed to do that. But as an anthropologist, it's not a bad idea to try and make sure the information is very broadly out at the broadcast, so that the community can say, what are your next steps for, you know, any remains you find? We don't want the remains back, so you do whatever you're going to do. Or we want the remains to go here. You know, let the community say, because they're related to them. But not act like there's no relations just because the cemetery is derelict. So that's a lot of different conditions, but I get that not everybody has the same philosophy about the dead, because we control them. You know, we the living control the dead. And if our attitude about controlling them is to put them into service, again, put those remains into service, then we'll do that. If our attitude is no, everybody goes to bone meal or everybody goes to ashes, then we'll do that. I was visiting New Orleans for the forensic meetings in February. We visited a local cemetery, historic cemetery for whichever county that is, parish, and they reused the burial spots. So the host had to tell us, he said, so you're anthropologists, if you see human bones, just leave them there. And sure enough, I didn't see any, but my colleagues did, which they did not leave there. They put soil on top of them, but they reuse those burial spots. Sometimes the person hasn't even been in there long enough to be fully skeletonized, is what the host said. But reuse is legal there. And that is their culture. And so, you know, when it comes to controlling the dead, I try hard not to judge as long as the person wasn't made dead for your purposes.
So kind of going off of next steps? Because you kind of talked about, like, where do we go from here with the community. What is the massacre investigation doing now? And
well, we're still in the field. We go into the field usually in the fall. I mean, you guys can't hear me shaking my hand. I'm shaking my hand because the idea is that the weather be less deadly and the heat. We used to go right at the start of the summer when everybody's summer schedule started, but it's just too hot.
Yeah.
And I'm heat adapted, but most of my colleagues are not. And so, and we're all getting older. So lest we add to the body count, which we've technically already done once, because we lost our best spokesman. He was our booster, Cabin Ross. He had a heart attack, not while we were in the field, but we still think the rigors of being public oversight committee chair and dealing with the stresses of his community ended his life early. And so we sure miss him. So we've broken that rule, but the... We're trying not to add to the body count. So we go out in the fall. We're still investigating Oak Lawn Cemetery. We're getting to the final push because we're now looking in the areas that we had, you know, they weren't obvious or there's some other impediment. And now we're having to ask ourselves if we've done our due diligence because technically, if there's a marker there, we don't check the space.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, but how do we know that it's a fancy casket under there? We didn't even look. We don't know what's under there. So, and with any search of burials, you know, you use above ground test, ground penetrating radar, or electrical impedance, or that third one, I can never remember. Until you dig, you don't know what's there. And we operated with a mix of, oh, but they have a nice marker, let's not move it. Because it is a nice marker. It's got to be them.
Yeah.
And with the full knowledge that we could put the marker back, because we've gotten very good at identifying that someone had a nice casket. And so, they were funeralized. Okay, next. So without even finding, we don't even get to skeleton material. We get to handles.
Yeah.
If we see handles, we document it and then move to the next one.
Yeah.
So my archaeological colleagues are very skilled at that. And so... But that didn't make us go back and look under markers. So I don't know if we're going to try to do that. But I worry that we won't be able to address the question of due diligence unless we do that. But
yeah.
We'll negotiate with the city and see what because that's the community, see mm-hmm. what the community wants.
The documentary mentioned that there was speculation that the Canes River might be a site.
Well, there's the area called the Canes. Yes, mm-hmm. It's a spit of land where the Arkansas River passes near a railroad trestle and highway and stuff. And so that was bare land in the 20s. Unfortunately, there's a third track on there where in the 20s there were two tracks. So we've looked at the area without tracks and where my colleagues putting the report together on that. But we still need to look at the area with the tracks and railroad companies, you know, the railroads they're like nations inside our nation. They control their land so exclusively. And, it's a process to negotiate that kind of work because and I can't blame them. The tracks are live. So, if they work with us to look under there, we have to coordinate everything very closely. And then what happens if there's something under there? Because that's going to take a minute, you know, to excavate. And, but on the other hand, we are looking for individuals that probably were picked up by the Oklahoma City National Guard, you know, on that June 2nd, even the afternoon of June 1st, because if you were dying on the 1st, I think we have their certificates. They died on the 1st. That means mm-hmm. they were shot on the 1st or the 31st. But if they were killed on the afternoon of the 1st and not collected, it's so hard to know because no one kept records of that. But on the other hand, I am often surprised that we have death certificates at all. So
I keep referring to the documentary, but in the documentary, several activists who were interviewed shared the view that the excavation of the Tulsa Race Massacre victims would initiate a process of justice. In what ways do you think this investigation has spurred this process, or perhaps was kind of seen as a catalyst that hasn't exactly been realized yet?
I think it did spur further actions to, now the definition of justice is problematic, but I see how Mayor Bynum's work was carried over by Mayor Nichols, the current mayor, and Mayor Nichols has initiated the Greenwood Trust, which it will produce varying degrees of justice, you know, because we can't provide the real justice, everyone's passed. And many of their descendants have gone on to live and do all the things. And so real justice, but I think we will definitely have the position of, you can't hide this history again. This event happened, and now people will more easily be able to say, I'm a survivor of that event, because here's the history, easily obtainable. And I know my history, I know my relevance to the past there. They'll be able to say that themselves. They'll know their connection. And that alone, that is one of the great powers of just genealogical research, giving people their background and letting them know on whose shoulders they stand. You know, that they aren't, whether they're, you know, struggling with employment or whether they're successful, they can know their mixed history that they derive from, and know their worth, know their historical worth. I mean, because their current real worth is their own make, but they can know their historical worth, and it's consoling and empowering at the same time. And so we're making that knowledge much more accessible to survivors of the event and to their neighbors. I just don't know that it will ever satisfy some of the critics of this process, because on the other hand, it's entertaining to say, hey, we were harmed, and we're taking away the ability to say we weren't compensated. So no, you're compensated now. And so that, I don't think that will please.
Some anthropologists and scholars argue that because ancestry estimation relies on techniques rooted in biological racism and race science, that the practice should be removed, or at least replaced by another practice. What do you think about this discourse, given the nuanced history of Black representation in science, but also the erasure of Black individuals from history?
Mm-hmm. Ancestry estimation isn't as much based on racism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it is closely tied, don't get me wrong. The problem with race versus ancestry is race is based on characters of biology and behavior. And unfortunately, every person gets to pick which mix they're using all the time, and they're always right. As opposed to ancestry, which is really only about who you're connected to biologically. So that biology can be the shape of your bones, it could be the shape of your soft tissue,
mm-hmm.
It could be your genes, and it will be your genes, actually, and the shape of your bones and your soft tissue. It will be the product of your biological engine. And with DNA analysis, you can actually take the stance of saying, hey, DNA, you know, sorry, it's not the DNA, hey, software. I mean, now we can do this. Just look for patterns in that software, and the software will go, hey, I see the same sequence of DNA here, 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 here. And then it's up to you, the interpreter, to realize that, oh, wait a minute, these people, they're from the same family, or the same country, or the same geographical area. So then what do you say? They're not related? Of course they're related. You know how genes are sorted. So the biology doesn't change. It doesn't care about race. It only cares about, yeah, I'm a chromosome, and I can sort myself, but only so far. You know, if those genes are next to each other, I have trouble cutting between them to separate them. So if you see both of them on someone else's chromosome, it's because we're family. And that's regardless of humans, dogs, cats. And we just don't appreciate it as much unless we're animal breeders, that biology is just its own process. It's a process. So, but race is another thing.
Yeah.
So the relationships, the biological relationships are real. So it just pays to go, I get that we have these race labels. If I am personally not aware of what I'm putting into the label, I am And especially when I don't know what the person I'm talking to uses in their labels, I need to have a careful conversation about whatever we're calling a race or using race terms to label. One of my favorite examples came from the medical examiner's office. A colleague had, she was producing death certificates, and she had an infant that had died, and the infant looked white, so light skin color, and white, and because it says race, so she puts white in. And the family, the mother, sees the death certificate, and she says, "You better change that to black. The father is black, and the baby's black." And she's like, "Okay." The infant was white. The infant's not white. The infant is black. And so they're both right, but the family is more right because they gave birth to the infant. And so I'm like, oh, race, here we go. Or one time when I was an autopsy assistant, I was in this busy morgue, and this white man is there dead, unfortunately a tourist. And but maybe that happens all the time, I don't know. He was a large guy too, but at any rate, the he had passed. We were admiring the shape of his head, and I was taking just taking notes, and the question arose of where he was from and who was he, and the guy was, I think, either Polish or because he was from some European country, very specific, but I think Poland, maybe. And so in the race category, the ME, instead of putting white, put Polish. And I said, "Wait a minute, you usually put white. This says race, why don't you put white?" "Because he's Polish." Oh my goodness gracious. I just, yeah. So someone later was going to have to go, "Oh, Polish? Oh, okay, probably white." But if he hadn't, what if he'd been Polish and black? I don't know what the world would have broken in half. So I don't know what and the goal of those labels is, for at least from my perspective, is to get people home. So use the label that the next of kin would use and or would look for. It doesn't do any good to argue about race and you want to use your labels, or you say, "Oh, I don't want to use any race labels." Next of kin uses race labels. The decedent used race labels. So
Interesting.
you need to get them home. We don't have to always throw out past science because it was based on difficult concepts, evil practices. So those ripple effects, how far does that ripple go? And it is an individual choice, but science, if it's science, can be recreated without the evil inside of it. So race versus ancestry, DNA ancestry is your ancestry. Those race labels in the census. This work with the Tulsa Race Massacre, those people need to go home. And so using race labels, ancestry labels, does it reify race, using race terms? Not in the modern sense, because we're dealing with people who lived and used those race terms in the 20s, we're using their terms. But people's choices today, we individually have to choose. We may not be able to affect what's put on our death certificates, but we can affect how we want people identified. And it's just, but I don't know, we're all about choosing our labels. So know your label. Just, know the one you want to use. And if it gets down to a combination of biology and behavior, know that you can change it. You can pick different labels over time. It's a label. It may get you sent home. So,
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me. This conversation has been very enlightening. I've learned so much. Thank you again.
no, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.